ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Book Show, where today I'm taking you somewhere over the rainbow. My name is Claire Nichols, and later you'll hear from Gregory Maguire, the man behind the novel Wicked, a book inspired by The Wizard of Oz. But before that, an author much closer to home who says The Wizard of Oz appears in some form in every book he writes. It's Trent Dalton. The Book Show is where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. And when it comes to favourites, I know the Australian writer Trent Dalton, he's right up there. The last time I spoke to Trent, it was to tell him that his debut novel, Boy Swallows Universe, had topped the poll for our top 100 books of the 21st century count here on ABC Radio National. It was a pretty emotional moment, and it was really lovely to finally, after that, meet him in person at an event in Perth to look back at his career and celebrate his latest novel, Gravity Let Me Go. This one is about a middle-aged crime journo, the incredible murder mystery that lands in his letterbox, and yep, it even has a little trip over the rainbow. Here's Trent and I on Whadjuk Noongar land with a huge and noisy audience.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you so much. Love you to bits. Honestly, it's so good to see your faces again, and you look so beautiful. Thank you.
And Trent, the last time you and I talked, I was calling to tell you that Boy Swallows Universe had come in at number one on our top 100 books of the 21st century count. We were both kind of giddy at the time. How have you recovered since that moment?
Yeah, it's almost irrecoverable. Like you can't, you know, process it. I want you to know what you did for my family, Claire Nichols. Can I just tell you something about one listener that was listening to on that weekend? Her name's Leonie. I wrote a book about her.
This is your
mum. My mum. Yeah. She was listening in the northern fringes of Brisbane, right? So you had listeners right across Australia, like thousands, like so many people got on board that thing. It was the most amazing weekend celebration of books, wasn't it? Like it was just such a, it was our people coming together. And I just wanted to tell you about this one listener, my mum, who's out in the northern fringes, and from Saturday morning, she's going like, well, you're below 80. and then, you know, we finish Saturday. She's like, you must be below 50. And then we keep going. And then my daughter, my youngest daughter, gets on board. She's a massive Marcus Zusak fan, right? Mm-hmm. So I walked past her bedroom one day and she was reading The Book Thief. And I'm like, it's amazing, isn't it? She goes, Dad, it's so much better than Boy Swallows Universe. Yeah. Oh, and that's my boy. Marcus Zusak is the loveliest man at the Perth. It was here. It was Perth Writers Festival, my first Perth Writers Festival. I was in a signing line, couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it wasn't the line up to the women's toilets. It was a line for me. And I was an hour in and I saw this handsome man still waiting with a copy of Boy under his arm, and it was Marcus Zusak. Wow. And I was like, mate, you could have pulled like Marcus Zusak privileges. And he said, no, this book's worth waiting in line for. That's just a side story about Marcus. And so my daughter was championing Marcus. Like she's like, go Marcus on the Sunday. And then we're all like, because, you know, it just became this incredible day. But my mum got out of prison, right? So I wrote about her years. She spent two really hard years in prison and, you know, a mum of four boys. I've got three older brothers and I wedged them into one brother called Augustine Boy. And she, you know, she got through 2 years and you know, people, hardened male criminals will tell you that a mum of kids will do a harder lag than any murderer inside prison. She gets out of that, right? But the next 5 years were even worse, Claire. Like, just in the middle class suburbs of Brisbane with the most horrendous 5 years of domestic violence she endured, right? There were periods, I'm sorry to get all deep so quickly, Claire, but I wanted you to know this. Like, she could have left us. Could have, I mean, left this planet, you know? And she had a belief system, this weird, absurd belief system that she had to stick around. All those times she kept on telling herself, stick around because your boys might do something worth sticking around for. I just want you to know that that's what we were all thinking about that Sunday afternoon, you know, and I had no eloquence when you called me. I was just nothing but emotion, and if I had any eloquence at all, I would have said that, you know, and I love you for doing that, you know. Oh, thank you.
Thank you for that story. So your mum knew that her kids were going to do great things. Was it known that you were a writer? Were you the kind of kid who had, you know, a street newspaper or anything like that?
Probably the earliest thing I wrote. I had these three older brothers. They were wondrous, you know, they were just, and we're sons of an avid reader. You know, my old man, Noel Dalton, you know, careful you bookworms, you've got to want more than just reading books and smoking durries, you know, because that's all my dad did. And he woke up in the morning, Claire, he rolled himself 20 drum rolled cigarettes. He slept on a high jump mattress that he got doing community service at the school opposite my school. He got it off the groundsman. He said, "Are you using that high jump mattress, mate? Because that'll be a nice double bed." Yeah, and he'd wake up and he'd smoke rollies and read doorstoppers like you. He read as much as you, Claire Nichols, you know, and you're just meant to want more in life, right? But all he wanted was stories and smokes. And he died of emphysema. And then he handed those books to my eldest brother, Joel. Joel handed them to Ben. Ben handed them to Jesse. And then Jesse went, "Trent, you're an idiot. You won't understand this." And I'm the youngest, but I later got into it. But those boys, we would gather around. It's amazing you say that. We would write little newspaper. I remember just being boys, and Joel started these. He's like, we're a press gallery, you know. He's like, I remember this one day, and it was the most exciting thing. We're around four boys around the table. We used to get up to all sorts of mischief, and writing was a big thing, and just telling stories, and it was huge. And then I started to really realize the power of it. You know, this beautiful guy, my dad, he had a lot of demons, and when Mum kind of went, you know, to prison and stuff, we went to live with Dad, and he was just, you know, drinking his demons away, you know, but still being there for us and loving us to death. But, you know, he'd be sort of pretty rough as guts some nights, and that's when you'd go in and just, you'd turn him into Merlin and turn me into King Arthur and, you know, like, just to take yourself away from a housing commission bedroom. And, you know, that's where the stories really be. I don't even talk about that much at all, but it's just that those early formative sort of years of writing were just deeply powerful. And I was doing the same thing that I do now, you know, like I am here because of that. I'm still doing that, like write your troubles away.
But it took you a while to find your way to fiction. You know, you started as a newspaper journo.
Yeah.
And then, of course, at some point you make the decision that this story that's been inside you all this time, Voice Swallows Universe, you know, I've got this story and now is the time to tell it. Once that decision has been made, how quickly does that story then kind of find its way onto the page?
Oh, that's a great question. I remember being, I was the Weekend Australian magazine staff writer. And I was your colour writer, like I was your, you know, I write it in boy, I was full florist. I was like, you'd go to me to write a really, you know, if there's been a tragic story happen or something, I was the guy who'd knock on the door gently and go, I'll go into this room, but I'll go in gently and I'll take your darkest hour, and I promise if I can work hard and work with you, I might leave you better than how I found you. And I remember one day I was in the newsroom, and I remember our court reporter, incredible reporter, Mark Schliebs is his name, comes back from a job. He'd been down at the courts on a retrospective murder story, right? It was a killing that happened in 1970s, corruption era Queensland. This guy screamed, I won't say it because this is going out on the radio, but I won't say the name, but he said this particular person's name. And then the chief of staff came and said, has anyone got a contact for, let's call him Rogers, you know? He's like, has anyone got a contact for Rogers? And I just remember, I'm flowery guy. I sank into my chair because I realised, Claire, I played with Rogers' kids at pig and the spit parties, you know? And I just remember going, wow. Like, I sat on that guy's lap. You know, and I remember being scared of that guy when I was a boy. And I remember instinctively thinking that man is dangerous. And I was right because he got put away on those charges. And honestly, Claire, like I remember that moment vividly, like I've got a scoop. I'm a journo who's been hunting scoops, and it's like the biggest scoop of my lifetime, Claire, was I knew that guy and I knew the other guy and I knew that guy. And yeah, my mum was in love with and, you know, deeply in love. He was the love of her life, one of Queensland's most notorious and most successful heroin dealers who knew every person in the zoo, you know. And that just blew me away that day. And I remember getting chills and going, oh, that's why I'm a journo. Like, I swear, I reckon I was a journalist till the age of 38, Claire, just to work out my own scoop. You know, is that strange? Like, I sometimes I think to sit there in that chair and hear that and go, oh, you idiot. Like, that's what you should be writing. You know, and I worked out how I would write it. I knew that I can be flowery guy. I'll be me in that story because that's interesting. Like, that's the interesting part of it, is that it's me. And I knew, ah, and Fee, my wife, can be the light, you know, and she can be Caitlin Spies. And it all just came to me. And then, sorry, in answer to your question, Claire, sorry. It's going to be a long night, mate. No, I'm sorry, Claire. Your questions are too darn good. But the writing, I wrote that like a effing fever dream, Claire. Like, you know, I do partly believe, like, you know, it's all part of the themes of my life. No family can endure the tough stuff like we did if it wasn't going to mean something. And that's an absurd thought and almost false belief, but it's a belief I had. And I had that in my mind. It's like, this is the meaning. And I would write like it was an electrically charged book. And it reads like it. It reads like it. It doesn't read like Hemingway or doesn't read like Tim Winton. It reads like a guy who's just shoving his heart and soul inside a laptop.
Yeah, it's your heart on a page, essentially. Oh. But I always wonder about the novels that come after that first novel, right? Because the first novel, for a lot of people, it's the story they always had to tell. It's the story that they have whatever time they need to tell it because they usually don't have a publishing deal. Yeah. Then you have success.
Yes.
Then you write the next book. Then suddenly, here's a publishing deal. We expect a book by this time.
Yeah.
You know, also, now you have to tell a story that isn't the one that's been kind of sitting in your pocket that whole time. Yeah. And you've done three novels since Boy Swallows Universe. Is the approach different? Is the passion different? Is the urgency different? Like, how does it feel to do the book that's not that debut?
Yeah. You know, and I got so caught up in myself that I was like, oh, poor Tranny gets to write a second book, you know. But I'll tell you what I did. Here's the weird thing. And I'm telling you, I only worked this stuff out 6 years later, right? So, like I've worked this out now. So there was this guy, and I'll call him Robert De Niro because he reminded me of Robert De Niro in Cape Fear. That's this guy. So picture that guy, and that's the guy who, I swear, Claire, I had nightmares about this guy, and he's the guy who gave my mum a hard time for a really long time. And I remember when I was a kid, my brothers and I used to talk a big game about, like, and so my brothers by that time, two of them were in the army and gotten out, and then I was probably 13 and starting to feel like I was some sort of tough guy. And I remember telling my brothers, like, I'm going to kill that guy. Like, one day I'm going to kill that guy. And my brothers laugh at that because they used to call me Blinky Bill because I used to cry so much and my eyes would like... They used to urge this. They'd see the tears coming, Claire.
Lucky you never cry anymore, hey?
Lucky I never cry. I can hear their voices. And they used to sing like the theme song to Blinky Bill. So whenever they'd see the tears coming, they'd go, "Hello, Blinky Bill." And the tears would eventually come. Anyway, they were like, "Trent, you're the softest out of us all, as if you could ever harm a hair on that guy's head." And what I wanted to say is, and what I wanted to tell you guys is this thing I've realised after about Lola. So I wrote All Our Shimmering Skies. It's a World War II story. It's this girl called Molly Hook, and she's running from bombs, and she's running from this evil presence who looks a lot like frickin' Robert De Niro if you read the descriptions. And I realised, man, I'm just running from De Niro. I'm running from De Niro in, like, All Our Shimmering Skies, I'm running from De Niro. Both of those books that came after Boy are just running stories. Yeah. And it's just kids running. And it's like, holy shit, I just haven't sorted out De Niro. And then you come to things like this and people go, "I've got a De Niro too," you know? And then you kind of share your rocks and other people grab your rocks and help you carry your rocks. And then this cool thing happened, Claire, where I realised, honestly, it was about only like a year ago, I realised I haven't had a De Niro dream. I killed the monster. Yeah. I killed him. Oh, man. Thank you. You're amazing.
So you kill the monster.
Yeah.
But now you've got to write another novel. Oh, and this is Gravity Let Me Go. So who's the monster now?
Oh, that is a profound question. It really is, honestly. So when you kill your monster and you look in the mirror and you don't see the monster anymore, who do you see? It's just you. So if you've got a problem, it's just you. That's Gravity Let Me Go.
And that is Noah Cork. So Noah Cork,
yeah.
Middle-aged guy,
yeah.
True crime journo, lives in Brisbane with his wife, his tween-age kids.
Yep. Tick, 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 tick.
But far from perfect.
Yeah.
You know, he's distracted from his family. He's obsessed with his work. If this is some version of Trent Dalton, it's not the most glowing representation of yourself.
Yeah, no. And I've had people go like, "I didn't really like that Noah Cork guy." And it's really like you go, "Oh, wow. Like maybe you see what my wife sees, you know." But yeah, I'll tell you, he is absolutely me, Noah Cork in this book. But he's me if I don't pull my head in, you know, Claire. Like, to be honest, like it's the worst aspects of me if they were let run riot, you know. And I wanted to write a book about the running. And ultimately, I swear, if you read Gravity, and, you know, like all my books, please read at least to, like, page 150. It's like... it's heading to the running and the cost of that, you know, the cost of the thought that you think you can put all your stuff inside a story and that it will all be solved, you know, but it's not solved for your wife, you know, it's not solved for your kids. You know, and it's like, that was really powerful to me. Like, I was like, yeah, I want to write about that. That's really important. And so I wrote this character who, yeah, he's so obsessed with this murder mystery that literally lands in his letterbox. I've had communications with criminals. I've always been fascinated by that. I didn't just always write flowery stories. I did write some hard true crime stories, and it got me into dangerous situations, and I was always taken with how far I would personally go for a story. And, well, this guy, Noah Cork, he's going to go so far he's almost going to endanger his own family. And I scare myself with how far I'd go for a story. So I wanted to write about that. And I scare myself when my wife, Fee, comes to me. And Rita in that book is the wife character. And it's like, it is Fee and it's totally not Fee. But, you know, there were times when Fee would come to me and I'd be like some idiot. And she'd just go like, "Sometimes I don't want to be with you anymore." And I'm like, holy smoke. Like, I was so lost in the running. I was so lost in De Niro that I didn't even see the thing that sustained me from when I was 20. You know, like, what an idiot. And that's Noah Cork.
Do you then hand the book to Fee and say, "This is me apologising, or would she prefer you just didn't write the book in the first place?
Claire, she wonders why I don't write about dragons like everybody else. Why can't you write...
Romanticy.
Romanticy. I would love to write... I would write the bleep out of a romanticy novel. I would... that's a mix of all my favourite... It's not my favourite thing. Yes. Yeah.
But you do love romance and monsters.
Love romance and monsters. It's kind of actually does describe my books, love and monsters. But, yeah, this incredibly understanding woman, she's the first to read it. I finished these. That book started, I was fascinated. I went out to my letterbox one day and I was in the suburbs of Brisbane and I was fascinated with middle-class suburbia, knowing all the dark stuff that actually happens in my middle-class suburb. You know, and that's cool. That makes for interesting writing. And it's, but, you know, some really heavy things have happened in my neighbourhood. So I, you know, tried as, you know, and Eli Bell in Boy, he's so hell-bent on getting to just middle-class Brisbane because, you know, he just thinks it's going to solve all his problems. But, of course, you go to those places and you realise it's as dark as anything that happens on the fringes. It just looks prettier, you know. And
nicer and lawns.
Exactly right. Better lawns, yeah. And, you know, I remember this day I was getting my mail from the letterbox. I looked at the neighbour's cat. I looked at the Nissan Pintara down the street. I looked at the wheelie bins in the road. I looked at the jacaranda tree and I just pictured all of us, me included, just being released from gravity for some reason. I was thinking about the moon and how the moon is sometimes wanting to get away from Earth, like it leaves Earth marginally. And I thought that would be a great metaphor for modern marriage. And then I thought, what if I just saw a scene in my head where everything in my boring neighborhood just got released and just lifted up into space. I went back down into my lounge room and I wrote down the words in a notepad. I always have a notepad going. I wrote the words, gravity let me go. I was released, like gravity just let me go one day. And then I thought, what if that was a line that was in the house? And what if it was that was the very heart of a mystery where a guy in his mid-40s maybe had to work out who has written that on the family mirror in the bathroom? Is it his wife or is it one of his two teenage daughters? And so then, you know, I'm telling you, like 3 months later or 4 months later, Claire, I've got my first draft and I run to Officeworks and I've got this doorstopper manuscript and I go, Fee, can you please read it? I'm so sorry. I've even called the suburb the same suburb as ours. You will recognise everything. I'm so sorry, but you need to read it, please. And then she you know, gets back with this red markers all over this and it's just no, 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 no. At one point there's a line in it that goes, what the F is in your head? And it's just the most honest feedback. And this is the thing about my writing, and I apologise to you, dear readers of Perth. Like, honestly, these are the books I have to write at that particular time. And I just go, Fee, I believe that is what art should be doing. Like, it should be dangerous and it should be scary to release and it should be awkward as hell. And then I know I'm doing something worthwhile, you know? I just, that was how it is. And then it's so meta. Because, Claire, like, we've done nothing but have heated marital discussions about this book that's about a couple having heated marital discussions. Can you believe that? Why would I do that? I cannot wait, I tell you, Perth, like, to write something that's just not personal.
Okay, so it's a self-sabotaging novel. Tell us about the story that has landed in Noah Cawke's mailbox. What is the story that he's so obsessed with?
Yeah, it's essentially there's a missing persons case and it's the scoop of this guy's lifetime that basically the killer has completely directed him to, you know, it's a breadcrumb trail to a woman wearing red shoes. This guy's got a distinct kind of theme going. And it essentially leads this guy to the body. And this guy, Noah Cawke, indeed writes a best-selling non-fiction book about this discovery. It's the moment of his life. And he realises, though, that he could come to the Christchurch chapel, and the killer could still be easily sitting in the audience still. And he realises nothing's been solved. And indeed, he's abused the killer because he's been in communication with this guy, and he's dropped a sort of mic drop moment at the end of his book, essentially just calling the killer just a piece of filth who doesn't scare him one bit.
A coward, right?
A coward. Calls him a coward. He calls him a coward. Noah has actually realised the error of what he's even doing is that he's only enhancing, you know, what he feels is a national problem with true crime. And so it's like, but mate, you're going to write a bestseller about it. But that all comes, you know, that all comes, Claire. Like, I would have conversations with incredibly dangerous people and incredibly scary people. I remember, I think this is sort of safe enough to say, I remember this guy did not get charged for anything, so I'm not saying lumping him in with any sort of killer, but I remember speaking to Ivan Milat's brother. Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I just hounded this guy, Alex Milat, and I said, mate, can I just come? He lived in my area up in Brisbane, north of Brisbane, Sunshine Coast. And I just hounded him. I got his number, tracked him down. I was like, Alex, it'll be a really worthwhile story. And he said, all right, I'm sick of you calling me. If you can be at this address at this time, you can come to my house and I'll open the door. That's all I'm saying. I'll open the door. And I jump in my car. I don't tell my editor where I'm going. I don't tell Fiona. We just had our eldest daughter because I was ambitious, Claire. I would have chased a story anywhere for copy. The things I did for copy, you would not believe. And I drove this guy's house, knock on the door. I open the door. Alex Milat opens it. He's shirtless, big beer belly, covered in tats. He looks just like his brother. And I walk into his house, very Spartan home. There's one thing sitting on his television, and it's in a photo frame sitting on his television, and it's a portrait of his brother, Ivan. And I remember halfway through our chat, I said, Alex, it looks like you really care still for your brother, even after everything he's done. And he got really insulted by this line of questioning. He goes, listen, let me tell you, we were raised to believe that killing a human is the equivalent of killing a snake. And I said, mate, you can't think like that. That's absurd. And he goes, stand up. And I stood up. Walk out that door. I walk out the door. Go down them stairs. This is how he's talking. And he comes out to the landing, and this is like no one was around, Claire. Like it was just 2 p.m. in the weekday, no one around. He comes out and he goes, see that door down there? And it was like a half a basement door buried into the earth where you have to hunch under and go into an underground basement. I swear, this is all in gravity, by the way. And he goes, go under there. And I remember just going, this is absurd because I shouldn't do this, but I went because I knew this was going to read amazingly on Saturday morning in the weekend magazine. You know this feeling. You're a journalist, and you're just like, this is gold. Keep going. Do what he says. And I went in and I was clocking all that. I went under this basement. I was clocking all the details, and there was all this machinery. There was like a workbench, and I remember there was a hammer like laying on this bench. And I was like, why would there be a hammer just laying awkwardly there on the bench? Like you would only place a hammer that way if you wanted to club someone over the head with it. And then he goes, keep going to the end. Go to the end of the basement. And he goes, further, further. And I'm like, what, you know, like, over here near these cobwebs. And I did, and I walked on. I was like, great copy, great copy. And he walks me to this machine, Claire, and it was like a medieval, like, metal-making machine or something. Like, it looked like something from the 50s. And he grabbed a lever, and he goes, put your hand in front of the... It was here, put your hand there. And it was like there was like a little scoop. He goes, just wait. And he pulls the lever and I hear this clank, 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 clank. And then a bullet landed in my hand. It was a bullet-making machine. And he was licensed to make his own bullets. He was a rifle shooter. And he cups the bullet in my hand and he goes, "Something to remember me by." Yeah, man. Oh, I love your Perth.
Okay.
But yeah.
This is really interesting because there is a high number of basements and underground lairs in your fiction.
Yeah.
And sometimes at those points in the novel, I'm like, well, this is a bit far-fetched. But then I think this is actually Trent Dalton's life.
Oh.
You've been into too many basements.
Claire, I swear, people won't believe. I swear to you. So people refused to believe that I didn't get my finger chopped off by a gangster. They'd come out at an event like this and they grab my fingers because in Eli Bell gets his finger chopped off and they go, "Give me your hands!" And I go, that was the one thing I embellished. But there was a secret room underneath this. The guy I was speaking about, he's this beautiful guy named Gary. He's alive to this day. It was a secret room in his house out at Ipswich, and my brothers and I found it when we were boys. And I remember they were making the TV show, and this incredible.
This is of Boy Swallows Universe.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, this is for Boy Swallows Universe. They were making an adaptation of Boy Swallows Universe, and this incredible art director, Michelle McGay, she's the art director on The Matrix. She's the woman who made The Matrix look like The Matrix, and she said, "I'm coming to Brisbane. I want to do the Boy Swallows Universe tour," essentially. And we went out to that house, Claire, and we went out and there was this guy renting that house. I swear to God, she goes, "Do you think we could go into that house?" And I was like, "Oh, it looks like someone's renting it." And we hopped out of the car. He had this pit bull, I swear, this unchained pit bull that came stalking along the grass. And I stood in front of Michelle as we were like, she's just looking at details, taking notes and stuff. And I'm like, "I think we should go back to the car." This guy comes out and the dog's name was Fighter. He came out and he goes, "Oi, Fighter, effing, get over here." He chains the dog up. And I go, "Mate, I'm so sorry to bother you. My name's Trent Dalton. I wrote this book about the years my brothers and I spent in the 1980s growing up in this house. It's called Boy Swallows." And he goes, "Boy Swallows Universe, effing loved it. Come inside." Kid you not. And he goes to Michelle, "You want to see the secret room?" Yeah. And it's still there. And Michelle could not believe it. It's way smaller than I wrote about it because I saw it when I was six. I saw it with a six-year-old's eyes. You know, my brother was Eli Bell's age. You know, my older brother Joel was Eli's age, 12, 13. And that is my life. It was a life of strange worlds in your own ordinary world, you know, finding strange worlds. That's why I'm far out. You're amazing, Claire Nichols. Like, that's why I write these stories. That's why I wrote Gravity. I'm setting it in the most boring Brisbane suburb, but I'm trying to show you that that's not boring at all, that place, you know.
And now we come to the portion of the chat where I have bought my first ever prop to a writer's event. I'm just going to wind her up and we'll just have a little listen. Okay, so she's playing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I think this one is particularly creepy because this Dorothy doll, while the music plays, her head goes around in circles and she doesn't have a mouth.
Look at her head.
But a beautiful song, Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Oh, yet maybe the most beautiful song.
When it's played like this, creepy. Why have I brought this prop in? Tell us.
There is a music box that Noah Corks finds in his letterbox, left there by a killer that plays Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And it was found on the victim's body and it was part of her possessions. And I find that song deeply moving as much as I find it terrifying. You know, I find that whole film terrifying, you know, in the most wondrous way. You know, I think that movie's the first horror story you ever sort of consume.
Yeah.
And I believe in that story so much. I believe in it the way David Lynch believes in that story. And I've written about that story in every book I've almost written, Claire. Like, and if there's a message in Gravity, Let Me Go, it is indeed, you know, literally the victim is there's a red shoe theme she has, and she's equally an avid fan of Wizard of Oz. But it's the deeper theme of the great realization that I've learned. There's no place like home. You know, it's just the simplest and most beautiful message. You know, it's like you try and climb to your zeniths, you know, you try and climb your mountains. And I really felt, Claire, like, if please forgive the indulgence, but Boyce Waller's universe was a massive mountain for me. You know, it was that flipping Radio National thing was a massive mountain for me, you know. But I swear I forgot along the way that it was about the hut at the bottom where Fee and the girls were. You know, I just forgot it, mate, just like an idiot, you know. And it was just like, just please remember there's no place like home. It's just like, it's so easy, you know, it's so simple, you know. And it's just like, I spent so long. There was this one time I remember coming home. I was telling Australia these wild tales about Boy and the secret room. And I remember going to my oldest daughter, Beth, who was at that time 12. She's like 18 now. I remember going home and I'd done this big tour. I came home and it's like, what'd you do down there, Dad? You know, and I'm like, oh, well, honey, I was telling all these wild tales about Grandma and me and your uncles, you know, and I started going into them, and she stops me, Claire. She stops me and she goes, I was getting emotional. I think it had all compounded or something, or the weight was dragging me down as I sat in literally a lounge with the most important person in my life. And I started getting it, and she goes, hey, Dad, you don't have to tell me those stories. Like, it's good, you don't have to be that guy. And she sort of parted my hair, like she was just like, you just have to play Monopoly with me. You know, like, you just have to be the hat in Monopoly. And you know what I mean? Like, that's all you have to be here.
Yeah.
And, that is, there's no place like home, you know?
It's pretty cool she lets you be the hat. That's a pretty highly contested piece.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they take the car and, you know.
No one wants the thimble,
No one wants that thimble. They still making the thimble? I know.
So, on the Wizard of Oz theme, in Gravity Let Me Go, we've got the red shoes, we've got the big storm that changes everything. And we have this touch of magic, right? And this is really pivotal to all your books. Yeah. Why is the magic or the magic realism such an important part of your work?
Oh, this gets back to Blood on Walls, you know. This is honestly, when I really started, my brain really started kicking in. It was, I think my brain... I know my brain. I was August. I was the mute boy. Like I just watched these beautiful brothers of mine. I watched all this wild stuff go around up until my dad thought I was like, he had to send me away somewhere to sort of get some, he just didn't know what was wrong with me. He told me this, like, and my brain started kicking in. I started having ideas in the very same time the world got violent for me, you know. And I just remember, just I would look at blood on a wall and a hole in a fibro, and I would then turn to a golden orb weaver spider that I knew was waiting for me at outside my bedroom window, you know. And I just know there are so many Aussie kids who do that. I just know for a fact, I've spoken to some who got old, you know, who got old and found their own light. And it's a recurring theme of finding imagination and magic in total darkness. And I just find that so powerful. And so therefore, for me, Claire, it's not magic. It's not magic realism. It's just realism. You know, I say that to people, like, for some kids, the thought of something being at the end of a rainbow is a very real thing, because it's the thing that's distracting them from the hole in the wall, you know, and the body on the ground, you know. And it's like, that's really powerful. And so I just pay fealty to that. I'm really in service to that sort of notion. And I know it goes over the top sometimes, and I'm sorry, you know, like, I really am. And next book I'm going to write, I promise, it's just going to be A to B to C equals D, you know. And they're my favorite stories. They really are, you know. But I can't help, and I think I'm actually in the darkness, and I think as 46, I'm doing what I did at 12, Claire. I think that's why it finds its way in there. Mm. I think I go, like I remember I was writing Boy, I could not write any violent scene. I could not write any violent scenes. Like I remember my editor, Catherine Mellon, she's just going, why did you write that bit about the violence as a, and this was the original draft, it was all retrospective letters that Eli was writing. He's like, oh, this happened once and he glosses over it. She's like, why don't you ever go into those real moments? And I was like, because they were real. And she said, if you do me the honour. So I do that real stuff, right? And then they turned that real stuff, Brisbane turned it into a play, right? And I had to tell my mum, I'm so sorry, mum, I've seen an early version of this, right? And there is the magic realism, mum, and you're going to love all that stuff. There is a Holden Kingswood that flies through the sky. It's beautiful, mum. It's beautiful. But before you see this thing, I hope you know, it's tough. And you will see a version of yourself, you know, you'll be reminded of the things you endured. And she said, Trent, what about my life makes you think I can't take 2 hours of Queensland theatre? And this is Australian mums. This is Australian mums and Australian women who endure this stuff that we have to absolutely eradicate. But this is the strength of them. And then this is mum, and she goes, you tell them, you honour me by not holding back. Do not sugarcoat that shit. You know, you honour me, Trent. You know, like, you show every other mum and every other woman who in Australia, you honour them by showing how effing terrifying it is to be in a kitchen with no exits. And I just got so freaking... Guess what she does now, Claire? This is the whole thing about tell someone's full story. Mum retires. She works at Budget Direct, right, in her later years. And she has to go into Budget Direct, knock on the door one day. She's worked there for like 15 years at this point. Her life is beautiful, you know. She's a great grandma who goes to Grandparents' Day, and she has to knock on that guy's, her boss's door one day and go, I'm sorry, boss. I'm sorry to bother you. I've just got to tell you that my youngest son has written this book. Don't worry, no one will read it. But just in case anyone does, you should know that it's kind of about the time I was a heroin dealer. And anyway, this beautiful guy, hats off to this person, if they're listening, calls her in 6 months later or something, and he's like, hey, I read your son's book. Mum's like, all right, I'll pack my things. And he's like, nah, if we didn't care about you before, we love you more than ever. You have a job here for life. And I can't say where she's retired now. And this is the thing. It's like, let someone have a full arc, hey, like give them a whole story, like support a community supporting a woman to allow her to, you know what I mean? Have a full life, have a full story. And now, she is a volunteer who helps women just like her in 1985. You know, that's what she does. Yeah, every Thursday, you know. So I'm just, these questions you're asking, it all starts at magic realism, but you know what I mean? Sorry.
We've gone on a journey. I love it. We've begun with mum and we've ended with mum.
Oh,
and I
wow.
think that's perfect.
Oh,
can
wow.
you please thank Trent Dalton?
Trent Dalton's latest novel is Gravity Let Me Go, and this is The Book Show with me, Claire Nichols, on ABC Radio National. We're keeping the Wizard of Oz theme going now with an archival interview with Gregory Maguire, the author behind the novel Wicked. Now, Wicked famously took the Wizard of Oz story and told it from the perspective of the villain, the so-called Wicked Witch of the West, examining her adolescence and life before Dorothy landed in Oz. The novel became a hit Broadway show. The second movie adaptation came out at the end of last year. And just before that happened, I spoke to Gregory Maguire about the inspiration behind the story.
Actually, I was working on Wicked when I lived in London 30 years ago. And I first got the idea to write a book about evil during that dreadful period of the murder of the child Jamie Bulger by those two schoolboys. Mm. When the schoolboys were identified, their names were splashed all over the papers. I understand the laws don't allow that anymore on the basis of this particular case. But when they were identified and their profiles were published, every talking head in the British Isles was asking the questions, how did two 10-year-old boys wake up in the morning, decide what to have for breakfast, decide they would skip school that day, and end up as murderers by nightfall? How could that happen? What does that mean about human capacity for ill intent and for human agency for crime? What does it mean about a lack of sympathy? What does it mean about luck and chance and human character? The questions were enormous. I'm part Irish, so I'm kind of glib, but I'm a slow thinker. And the only way that I actually ever find out what I think about anything is to write a story and then read what I've written. And then I can kind of deduce what it's about. So I decided to take the novel, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, made famous by the 1939 film starring Judy Garland. And I decided to use that armature as a kind of scaffolding upon which to drape my various and sometimes conflicting theories about what evil actually is, about where it comes from, and also about why we find it useful to name other people as less moral than we are, less good, and perhaps less deserving of holding on to life than we are.
It seems fascinating that you chose this story, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, as your tool, I guess, to explore this idea. But if we know more about you, Gregory, it makes sense because your whole world had been children's stories, right?
That's true. I have a master's degree in children's literature, and I had written, a dozen novels for children or so by the time I became vexed about the problem of evil. And so I also was a little bit timid. You know, Claire, people always give writers advice. Write what you know. Don't try to write something that you are uncomfortable with. Write what you know. So when I decided that I wanted to write about evil, I thought, well, what do I know? I'm 38. I'm kind of innocent. I'm an innocent abroad, almost literally. What do I know? I know church music and children's books. Where's the evil in either of them? And then I remembered The Wicked Witch of the West, who in fact even has wicked as part of her name. She is the Wicked Witch of the West. And she doesn't have any other name. That alone suggested to me that I had been vouchsafed with a holy vision. My whole life as a Catholic boy, I'd expected to see the Virgin Mary coming out of the clouds, but when the clouds finally parted, it was Margaret Hamilton saying, I'll get you, my pretty. And so I had my miraculous apparition, and it was the great idea of my life, I think, and I ran with it.
Yeah, it's fascinating because, you know, you've done a lot of work, and since then you've done a lot of work in fairy stories, right? And The Wonderful Wizard of Oz is not technically a fairy story, but I guess because it's had all these different versions of life, we've got the L. Frank Baum novel, we've got this film that is so well known, and then, of course, you've contributed to the legacy there. It does feel like the Yellow Brick Road and the Emerald City are kind of part of our cultural understanding of the world.
Well, I think so. They are not old enough, really, to become the archetypes of culture whose roots cannot be traced. We can trace where L. Frank Baum came from and even where a lot of his ideas came from. But ideas mature and images have their own plan for permanence. And so the Yellow Brick Road and the Twister that carries Dorothy away and the Emerald City are now almost archetypes, even though somebody actually invented them.
You took on this children's story and you did make it dark and sexy and adult. What was the reaction when you said, you know, I'm going to make The Wicked Witch of the West real and sexy?
Well, almost everybody liked the idea, but a number of people said, you better get an unlisted phone number because there are going to be people out there who think you have no right to play with our sacred myth, especially as Americans. Americans can be very territorial. I was thinking more about American disapproval. We cherish and hold up, sometimes in blind ignorance, that which is appealing at the moment. So I knew I was possibly going to suffer the cudgel of disapproval from the Wizard of Oz fans, especially in the United States. In fact, Claire, one time when I was reading from Wicked 30 years ago, I went to Kansas, of all places.
Oh, the state there's of Kansas. No place like home.
There's no place like home. And I spoke to a college auditorium, fairly filled with people. Afterwards, one woman came down to the front. She had a collared raincoat. The collar was up against her ears, and she had a snap-brimmed hat down over her brow, so I could hardly see anything but her nose and her mouth. And she came to me, and she leaned forward in a very soft voice, and she said, "I am the president of the International Wizard of Oz Club, and I came tonight to spy on you and to find out what wickedness you were spreading. And I have to tell you, I'm a convert." She threw off her hat. She threw open her rainbow. She gave me a big hug. And she said, "You have not besmirched our beloved national myth. You have actually amplified it, and you have made it possible for adult readers to go back to rejoin the territory of their childhood literary experiences and to enjoy it in a new way."
Gregory Maguire speaking to me in April last year. He has a new book in the Wicked story. It's called Elfie. It's a prequel to the prequel. And if you want to hear more about that, you can find our full interview in our archive. Just make sure you're following The Book Show on the ABC Listen app. Thank you to producer Sarah Lestrange and to operator Carrie Dell. We make this show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.